Hello and welcome to the Music to My Ears podcast, brought to you by BBC Music Magazine, the world's best-selling classical music monthly. This week, editor Oliver Condy travelled to Bath to meet the world-renowned harpsichordist, fresh from a superb recital with recorder player Michala Petri at the Bath Barkfest back in February. Wandering through Bath's Georgian Centre, past the Royal Crescent and around its parks, Mahan shared his musical passions and discoveries with us. His new album on Hyperion is called Musique and features the music of Henry Cowell, Gavin Bryars, Kayasari Aho and more, and is out in July. This podcast was recorded before the coronavirus lockdown.
You've just given a recital with a wonderful Michala Petri.
Yes.
Performing Bach and some Dutch music.
Bach, she played some Jacob van Eyck and I played some more Bach. That's for the Bachfest, you know, so...
And using your own harpsichord. Tell us a bit about that.
Yes, using my harpsichord, which I've recorded quite a few things with. I did Bach toccatas with it. My next album, which is all electronics and contemporary music. It's an instrument that I designed with the builder Jukka Olika, who's in Prague, and uses carbon fiber, and it's big, and it's loud, and it's brassy, and it's just...
It's just
we call it the Queen Mary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What? Because it's just a massive cruise ship.
It's like the ship.
Yes. Yeah. You can hear, sitting right at the back of the hall, you can hear every single line. And actually, in a harpsichord concert, with or without recorder, you can't necessarily hear the lines.
Well, you know, the thing is, I always liken the harpsichord compared to, say, an orchestra. It's like a pencil sketch, and that has its own expressivity, right? But this instrument I kind of commissioned also to play modern music, but also because I think Bach does demand those big lines. You know, Bach is the way he thinks his phraseology. That's a pretty pretentious term, but I mean his architecture asks for, you know, pretty versatile instruments, I would say.
And the idea that actually Bach needs prissy playing, when you look at even, well, the organs that he was playing with all the stops and the volume and the actual physical effort that was needed to play a lot of that music, it just seems sensible. Seems logical that you should bring out something big.
I think so. I think there's a balance to be found, you know, always. I mean, we're not going to go back to the way people played Bach in the 1940s or 50s. You know, we have to be ourselves. But also this idea that we're creating or recreating something 200-300 years ago, well, that's just not defensible philosophically. But hey, that's a big subject.
Yeah, and we're standing here in microphones in the Royal Crescent.
That's right. I mean, talk about authenticity.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, you know, this is heavy set stuff. This is 30 terrace houses built around 1756, 1760.
Yeah, that's right. So Handel would have missed it. But Haydn... I think there's even a description by Haydn of coming to the Royal Crescent. He described Bath as the most beautiful city in Europe. And we have one of his very few religious remarks where he says, it is so beautiful, this country, and the people are so wonderful. What a shame that they're not of my religion. It's the one time he sort of criticizes that Britain is Protestant, which is very strange. But he came to Bath, I believe, once or twice. He was greatly admired in Bath. Of course, Bath was then, as now, quite a chic town.
Yeah.
And people brought in the best.
There's a danger it can be treated like a museum. We talk about Haydn saying it was the most beautiful place in Europe, but is it too much of a museum? I don't know.
I mean, it's like
music, isn't it?
Could Bach
be treated too much as a museum? Can that music be put in too much of a...
You know, it's not... We're not going to get a sense of how these people thought or... I mean, I always quip, do you like period toilets, right? I mean, if you really had to live the way people did... You know, it would be tough. But I mean, at the same time, you know, you have to understand, I mean, a lot of the building and the neoclassical building that was going on in Britain, it is meant to evoke and comment on a sort of idealized idea of life and an idealized idea of aesthetics. So the city is, I don't want to say it's built as a museum, but it's built as an idea. Mm. Bath is very much an idea. Mm. And, you know, so that gray area, that indefinable space between ideal and reality. I mean, I would also say that it's a city that it clearly has adapted itself to the modern age. You can live in it, can't you? And of course, we were just saying before we started recording that Bath was not a very nice place.
You can live in some areas. I mean, there's still the division, isn't there? You know, the sort of the people who can live in the most beautiful places
do
live in the most beautiful places. I mean, you know.
But it was like that back then.
Yeah, you know, very true. Very true.
It's ever changed.
Very true. I'm really fascinated by the first piece of classical music you ever fell in love with. Really, I think it's the one that sets us on a road to where we're going. I mean, maybe it doesn't with you. I don't know. Your tastes always seem quite.
Well, I can
eclectic.
Tell you what the tune was.
Yeah.
Da-dun, 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 da-dun. Da-da.
Da-da.
Da-da. Da-da. Da-da.
Tchaikovsky 4. Tchaikovsky 4.
It's that first movement.
It is the first movement.
It's and that's the first piece of music. I broke the cassette. Remember cassette tapes? I broke the cassette tape listening to that. I had Karen when I was in high school. I think the cassette we had was, I must have been a recording that I got later on, which is Kondrashin, Leningrad.
Okay.
I think it's Leningrad Symphony. Yeah, Kirill Kondrashin.
Amazing. Emotive.
I mean, which was DG. Yeah. And also those, I mean, that Leningrad fill, that oboe section. Oh my God, it's like ducks from hell.
Yeah.
I will never forget listening to that recording. And I think I have it on my iTunes now, so.
I mean, I have to say that second movement is, I think, one of the most beautiful written in the 19th century.
I mean, he is truly a European composer, Tchaikovsky. You know, he's not a... It's funny because he gets a kind of bad rap from Taruskin and the whole idea of what is Russian nationalism in music. But you know, what the Russians wanted to do was to be cosmopolitans in music. But you ask any Russian, you know, Tchaikovsky is a deeply Russian composer. There's this concept in Russian, it's called Tuska. I'm very interested in Russian literature, so I'm always reading about this stuff. And Tuska is this kind of indefinable, inexorable melancholy that exists in Tchaikovsky. You know, even when he smiles, he's sad.
Yeah.
He's always accompanied me in my life, Tchaikovsky, in a way that only maybe Bach has.
Yeah, I find myself gravitating towards music like that most of the time. Music that sort of makes you, I don't know, cathartic is a too simplistic way to think about it, maybe, but a sense that the music's following you in your life.
Well, you might say that the Slavic...
You, comforting you.
The Slavic view of life, I mean, I live in the Czech Republic and they have this, is that life and art are inextricable from one another. Life is art. I mean, maybe it's harsh to say this, but we're in a city which historically in the 18th century bought its culture. Yeah. But to Slavs, even if you don't have anything, culture is culture. Yeah. And... that's what I feel very deeply with Tchaikovsky. Maybe I also have a wistful attraction to it because as a harpsichordist, I'll never be able to play any Tchaikovsky, right? I can't transcribe. It's not going to work. So great. I get to sit and listen to it.
Yeah. I mean, there is a sense that sort of music has been brought into modern day living, you know, back in the day. I mean, returning to Bach, Bach was the name for musician that was interchangeable. Music was just what everyone did. Music was just part of sort of everyday living. Whereas now it's slotted into lunchtimes, it's slotted into evenings. It's kind of, it's your bread and butter, but still music is still something that's treated as a commodity rather than...
Because we have access, we can just turn on something in our phones and listen to music. I mean, other people, you know, people have talked about this at length, but, you know, when Bach went to hear Hasse's Kleophyta in 1731, when he went to hear Telemann conducting Handel's Ariodante, which was translated into German in 1735 in Hamburg, Bach would have heard it once. That's it. It's not, you know, he couldn't go on his sound system and listen to Hasse again. The way Bach processed music would have been largely through scores, but also clearly an ear of great discernment and one that would have picked up things. But how many chances would he have had necessarily to hear a piece of music? I mean, why does Mozart have, 26, 27 piano concerts? Last one is B-flat 27, yeah. Because they're 27 different concerts. You hear them once. Mozart played them once. You know, the other recorded instance we have of someone playing the famous D minor, K-466 of Mozart, is Beethoven playing it on a tour. Beethoven plays it somewhere like Frankfurt or something. So in Mozart's time, he plays it once. And so in that sense, I say, well, one can lament that, one can bemoan that, but also we will never understand how they thought. We will never, in a sense, that preciousness of music for them is something that... I have to say we can strive towards, but we will never know what that feels like.
And just as much today, a performance is fleeting, so the music itself is fleeting. So tell me, what's the best classical music concert you've ever been to?
I wonder if I have so much Tchaikovsky on my mind. Okay, so was it a concert? I wasn't supposed to be there.
Yeah. Should we walk a bit?
Let's walk and look at the Royal Crescent. I mean, I'm looking at you, but I really want to look at the Royal Crescent, you know, to be honest. Yeah, no, I was at Edinburgh Festival last year, 2019, and one of my close friends, she She works for Edinburgh Festival in the summer. She's actually a dramaturge and programmer at Barbican. And she, I was up in Edinburgh Festival for some concerts. And she said, hey, you know, you have a free day between two of your concerts. Why don't you come? Komische Oper from Berlin is bringing Barry Kosky's production of Yevgeny Onegin, again, Tchaikovsky. And, you know, they've got to do a closed dress rehearsal the night before in the festival theater, a kind of technical rehearsal. Why don't you come along? And I will never forget being, she snuck me in. I was the only person in the Edinburgh Festival Theater that night.
Really?
And they did all of Evgeny Onegin with Azmi Grigoryan as Tatiana, who's amazing. And I just remember sitting there in the balcony, being alone. The curtains opened, and 3 hours later, the curtains closed. And I thought, what the heck just happened? I felt like it was a performance for me only.
Yeah.
And I...
There's magic in shared experience, but there's also magic in sort of music just being projected in your direction.
Yes. And also they weren't really performing for an audience. They were performing just to be great. They were performing for themselves. And no one marked. That was amazing. Like, Russian singers don't mark, man. They really, they did it full. They full out. In the third act, there was rain, real rain on stage. During the letter scene, I remember Azmi Grigoryan just beating her chest and going crazy. And I thought, I will never experience anything like this. And soon afterwards, I bought a new translation that Pushkin Press has done of Yevgeny Onegin. Unfortunately, I can't understand the Russian. And in my mind, the whole time I read it over holiday, I just thought of that production. That's where you say, you know, again, that 18th century, 17th century experience of hearing something once.
Yeah.
It will always stick with me that I had that experience.
And that sort of private music making for yourself is just so important. Even if the artist was concentrating on it being a dress rehearsal, you know, it was still, as you say, something that they wanted to do for them. They didn't necessarily know you were there. So I'm just sort of wondering, how much do you play for yourself as opposed to practice? Because you have to spend a lot of time preparing new repertoire, but how often do you manage to sit down and just go, you know what, I'm going to really relish this for me?
The issue of working for yourself is a very interesting topic. I mean, I think I learned, we are entertainers, right? We are playing for others. The idea that people are just kind of witnessing us practicing is, I think, slightly pretentious, and I think it's a bit nonsensical. I think we are there for others. Performers who have contempt for their public, I've never understood. You get some performers who get up there and either they lecture the audience, which I just cannot be bothered with that, or they just want to show how smart they are, you know, make the audience feel stupid. I think we are there for the audience because I want you as a listener to feel what I'm feeling, to know why I want to spend my time with this music. Having said that, however, yeah, you do learn to play for yourself in the sense that you learn to be yourself. You know, you learn to trust yourself. And that actually has only come for me maybe in the last year. Something about hitting 35 and you're like, okay, I'm at a time of my life. Like, I'm older than Schubert was when he did everything. I'm older than Mozart was.
Yeah, sigh of relief, you know.
Yeah, sigh of relief. Like, okay, just kind of, it's not downhill
Purcell
from
tick,
here.
Mozart
yeah,
tick, Purcell, Schubert tick.
Yeah, like, you know, Pergolesi, whatever. Janis Joplin, you know, like, you know, Amy Winehouse, and you think, okay, you accept things for the way they are, but also, I don't know, there's this thing about believing that you have something to say without shouting it.
So I want to know what your current musical obsession or obsessions are.
Yeah, I've been listening to Yosef Tal, who's an Israeli composer. 1950s, 1960s, avant-garde, did the first stuff with electronics, actually, in Israel. Wrote a big work for harpsichord electronics, which I'm going to start learning soon. So I've been getting to know his other music, and he wrote these great symphonies, and I've been kind of grooving to his second symphony lately.
So what are they like? Are they with electronics as well, or were they...
No, it's all I suppose you would call it acoustic. The thing with a lot of Israeli music, there's Chaim Alexander, there's Paul Benheim, there's Yosef Tal, is that these are fundamentally European composers, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they're all born in Europe. They're born in Poland or Germany or Lithuania or whatever. And so they're kind of, they're continuing the tradition of European art music and the trends that go on there. I mean, a lot of it sounds like Shostakovich and Weinberg and, okay. yeah. and things like that. But yeah. also, you know, they are forging sort of national identity in music. And they and guys like Chaim Alexander, they look a lot into Middle Eastern music, actually, right? So I'm kind of, I'm fascinated by that period of composers. And Tal, there's, oh gosh, there's Halbenstock Ramati. You know any of his music?
No.
Amazing. Halbenstock Ramati did all this stuff with concrete notation, which I really find fascinating.
What's concrete notation?
You know, non-traditional visual notation.
Okay. Kind so of more like, sort of pictorial scores where you're pictorial scores, you know, directing like, physical sort of elements rather than pictures.
Yes, but in the case, I mean, like Cornelius Carju did that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And Carju, you know, he's very ambiguous about whether these are specific markings or not. It's not just a matter of interpretation. He claims that it's specific, but I don't know. I mean, what Carju says and what he means is very difficult to figure out. But.
Is there a bit of Tal we should go away and listen to?
Second Symphony.
What piece of music could you absolutely not live without?
Oh, man.
So, you know, this is a really hard ask. You know, one piece of music.
Ah, this is going to be super controversial because everyone wants to make some...
Well, we all think you're going to say Bach, don't we?
Yeah, everyone's going to be like, because From Heaven...
Because he's a harpsichordist.
Down,
yeah.
The Passion, Matthew Passion and blah, 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 yeah. Virtue Signaling. No, I'll be honest with you. Elgar First Symphony. I'm all about that symphony, especially the last, like the last minute or last 2 minutes of that symphony.
Yeah.
Just fascinate the heck out of me. I remember the first time I went to hear it. It was part of a concert where you know what? Martin Brabbins was conducting the Philharmonia, and he and I had done some stuff before. So I went to see him, and I sat, and he got me a ticket, and I sat with his wife, and he gave us a copy of the score, and he said, hey, by the way, note in the last movement when the theme comes up from the back of the first violins. Yeah. So I'm sitting there with his wife, listening to this, following the score, totally marveling at the symphony. And then that section comes, and that is an unforgettable moment. Perhaps it'll always be identified for me with, like, being a friend, you know, of the conductor, and I was in a nice environment with people I liked, and... Mm. And so this symphony, I really can't get enough of it.
When that symphony was performed, we all kind of assumed that these symphonies weren't appreciated back then and we're only really starting to realise their greatness. But, you know, people were saying Elgar is the greatest composer, not only in the UK, but the greatest living composer in Europe, in
That's
the world.
Right.
You know, people realised that Elgar was the most important musical figure of his time.
I think it was Hans Richter or it was Hermann Levy or someone who wrote a colleague in London and said, do you know in England that you have the greatest composer, and his name is Elgar.
Mm.
It's amazing to think, I always look back on that Ken Russell film about Elgar, that people in England didn't know. They didn't know. Elgar was again, to use that term, he was a European composer, and people didn't know how great he was. I really can't get enough of that piece.
But I think Elgar is one of those composers who is equally brilliant in the miniature music as he is in the chamber music, as he is in the grand grand sweeping statements. You know, we tend to think of Elgar as this great, well, some people do, as this sort of great nationalistic figure.
She's not.
But he's not. He was a depressive private man. You know, he was a very, in many ways, a very lonely, very sensitive individual.
He's also a perpetual outsider in British society.
Yeah.
Another outsider who doesn't even get the kind of establishment respect in England would be Malcolm Arnold.
Yes.
And I very much, lately I'm really appreciating his symphonic works. Mm. There was that series on EMI where I think there's a recording of him conducting his Fifth Symphony. But he's someone who, I mean, yes, he was Sir Malcolm Arnold, but he's never been taken seriously as the serious composer that he should be.
There's a rumor, and whether it's true, probably an urban myth, that when Malcolm Williamson was made Master of the Queen's Music, that actually they chose the wrong Malcolm. And the people making the decision were the people in Whitehall. And, Malcolm Arnold should have been the man. And I can sort of believe that, because I think he was overlooked. I think his music, those symphonies are incredible.
Certainly, I feel that Malcolm Arnold frequently makes me reflect on life. To think, not that you're suggesting this, but to think that this is somehow popular or populist or Team GB music totally misses the point. And I think a lot of people do think that. They do think it's not serious music. People remember him from, what was the name of that piece? Padstow Lifeboat? That stuff is fun, right? But that's not easy to write, first of all. No. Secondly, you listen to the Fifth Symphony, especially the third, fourth movements, where it's a hymn to his friends who fell in the war. You know, that there's this indescribable pain that he clearly, the guy drank himself to death, essentially, didn't he? He drank because he couldn't, he was of a generation that couldn't talk about that.
Want to know what your, is there sort of a film you've been to see recently or a book you're reading that you would recommend to us?
So I read a lot. I try to read a book a week. So
That's impressive.
Well, hey man, when you're traveling a lot, there's not a lot to do but read. And let me tell you something, when you do long haul flights, actually to limit your exposure to media is a good thing. It really messes with your head. So,
well, there are curry menus, are they? Because you collect curry menus, don't you?
I do collect curry menus. That's right. As you learned last night when I requested a takeaway menu. That's right. I do collect curry menus. It's a hobby. I lately have been reading a lot of Japanese fiction. A lot of Soseki and Tanizaki, Murakami, writers like that. Partly because, I'm not sure I should admit this, I don't feel a massive sympathy with Japan. Like, when I go there, I don't feel good.
In what sense?
I find it very doctrinaire, very reserved. So I started reading a lot of Japanese fiction because I was like, this isn't right. You know, why is it that I don't really jive with Japan? So I thought, I go to an English bookseller in Prague, and... Yeah. I order a lot of books, so I said, hey, order me like 10 Japanese novels, and let's do this. Let's figure this out. So I'm on my third one right now. It's called Sanshiro by Soseki, who was a Japanese writer in the 19-teens, 1920s, 1930s. And it's a coming-of-age novel. It's about a young man who goes from Kyushu to Tokyo and goes to university, and I very highly recommend that. And then I just finished Soseki's magnum opus, which is a book called The Makioka Sisters, which is about a sort of chic family from Osaka and their kind of decline as a family. And I quite like both of those books.
And I suppose reading Japanese, you know, culture that's so different from the stuff you're playing, it really separates out your leisure in your work.
Well,
is that right?
I mean,
is
that a question? I mean, you might say that a great deal of 18th century, 17th century music is produced in cultures where one does not say what they mean. So it's not that different, you know.
So I think I'm going to head to the station. I don't know about you. Where are you
going?
Yeah,
I got to go to Birmingham. I got a recital at Town Hall tomorrow.
Town Hall. That's a great venue.
Yeah, I'm playing McConkie
Fantastic.
I'm playing some Friedemann Bach. I'm playing some Gibbons. Yeah.
So should be fun.
Forward. I got to practice. Solo? Yes, solo recital at Town Hall in the round.
Well, best of luck with it.
Thank you.
And it's great to see you.
Looking for you. Yeah, good to see you, man.
See you soon. Another curry.
Yes, many curries.
That was harpsichordist Mahanis Vahani there on his musical loves. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the team at BBC Music Magazine. Let us know what you think by rating and reviewing it wherever you've been listening. If you want to find out more about BBC Music Magazine, we're available in print and in various digital formats, or you can visit our website, classical-music.com, where you can read all about the latest music happenings, read thousands of reviews, and a good deal more. Thank you to Acast for hosting this podcast, and to our producers, Ben Newitt and Jack Bateman.